This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aul. Long-serving Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens is stepping down, and it will likely create a battle in the Senate as President Obama has suggested he will look to appoint someone with the same ideology of the liberal Stevens. It will certainly create a summer of speculation on who the nominee will be, and we'll get a jump start on that today. Also, President Obama is looking to clarify his position and plans for NASA and space exploration. He has many critics and few allies for his previous statements on the space program. We'll talk about those topics and more. It's Politics Day. Stephen Schmidt from Iowa State University and New Hampshire-based political analyst Arnie Arneson are our guests. We'll also have your phone calls and emails. Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio coming up after this check of news from NPR and Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aul. It's Politics Day. Our guest, Stephen Schmidt, political science professor at Iowa State University, joins us from our studios in Ames. Good morning, Stephen.
Morning.
And Arnie Arneson, New Hampshire-based political analyst, is on the line as well. Good morning, Arnie.
Good morning, Jonathan.
So this week, John Paul Stevens made it official. He's stepping down from the Supreme Court. Apparently working into his 80s is enough for him. And this has already started a firestorm of speculation, and we're in the business of that as well. So what I'd like to start by asking both of you is, do you think President Obama is going to try to find someone that will get some Republican votes, or bolstered by the health care passing and some other things that have gone on in Congress, will he go the way that he wants to go? And he's already given some indications that he wants somebody with Stevens' ideology. What do you which way do you think he'll go?
Well, I think he'll go female. Number one, I think that's what he's going to do, because I think he's worried. While there are two females on the bench, one of them is very, very frail. So I think he's going to look in that direction. And I also think that they know that Stevens will probably be replaced with someone like Stevens. But then, how do you know? Because look at Justice Stevens. He was a Republican. He was appointed by a Republican. The Republican president who appointed him probably never imagined that he would end up picking like the quote liberal lion currently on the Supreme Court bench. I mean, it's so amazing when you think you know what you're going to be handing a court, what you ultimately end up with. What I do hope, and this is really important to me, Jonathan, but I have become more and more apoplectic about when a justice, in this case a Supreme Court justice, knows when to recuse themselves, or maybe knows when to suggest to their spouse they should hold their powder. And what I'm referring to is Justice Clarence Thomas. And the reason why Clarence Thomas is important in the Stevens decision is that obviously whoever is going to be nominated by President Obama is going to have to go through a grueling process in the United States Senate. One of the questions I hope that is asked over and over and over again of any single person that is going to be nominated by Barack Obama is that, are you going to be like Justice Clarence Thomas and not know when to recuse yourself? For example, Justice Thomas has been involved in cases involving Monsanto. Justice Thomas used to work for Monsanto as an attorney. He has not recused himself. I'm just hoping that whoever they pick understands when recusal is critical and important for the country.
Stephen, your take?
Well, I think the other criterion that that Obama is going to probably have to use is it's going to have to be a Protestant, because it's an extraordinary situation that the Supreme Court of the United States has Catholics and two Jews and one Protestant who is now retiring. And religion does matter. And affirmative action, or let's call it representation of different groups in the country, in the policy and legal process, does still, I think, carry some weight. So I think that's another criterion. I also think that he probably at this point would rather not have a confrontation with the Republicans, although it's going to be inevitable. The Republicans are bound and determined to not give him an easy slide through, no matter who he appoints, which has been typical, actually, of Supreme Court nominations lately. You know, it used to be a civilized process, but once upon a time, a Supreme Court nomination was the president's choice, and in the modern period, it's been the president's choice, but having to essentially endure incredible bludgeoning of the nominees by whoever happens to be the opposition to the president. And, you know, the Democrats have done as thorough a job of making that process grueling and torturous as the Republicans. So I can imagine that this one is going to be that way.
I think they also have a problem here, and that is that the Republicans now are really becoming the neon party of no, because they screamed no, threatened death panels, turned the health care reform bill into basically a death bill. They're right now about to start screaming about the financial reform bill, which I think 98.9% of Americans agree that Wall Street screwed up and your bank screwed up and people got rich at the expense of the American taxpayer. People got rich based on people's being, you know, misled about mortgages and subprimes and derivatives and all kinds of products nobody understood, including the bankers. And then they're going to say no on a Supreme Court justice. I hate to say that, but that doesn't lend oneself to suggesting that this is a party that cares about a country and wants to sort of stabilize us, because we are going through a huge economic downturn. And how do you recover when one party is kicking and screaming and only capable of saying no when reform is absolutely essential?
But Arnie, isn't that the role of the minority party? I mean, when George Bush was in office and Republicans controlled everything, what actions did the Democrats?
Look what happened. They voted for wars. They voted for welfare reform. There's been a lot of stuff. And I understand that you have an informed no is what you need to do, that you need to bring your bias, your political perspective, your economic sophistication to the table. This is about a hissy fit that has no relationship to content or context. And I think in the end, they have a great opportunity to actually grab a huge number of votes this November. I think they may actually sacrifice some of those opportunities by looking like they really are not a party that has statesman or leadership capacity. They are a party that basically is obstinate and knows how to stand in the way of change, which is crucial for both Republicans and Democrats.
But I think, Arnie, the problem is when you said 99.9% of Americans, blah, 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 99.9% of Americans actually have no idea what's going on, are not really well informed. We've seen all the polls. People don't read the news. They don't watch the news. CNN is collapsing. Yes, Fox has big ratings, but they're tiny ratings compared to the 300 million, you know, people with a pulse that we have in this country. So most people get little snippets of stuff, and most of that is coming from critics of this administration. The Democrats have done really an unbelievably poor job of explaining all this. They are inarticulate. They are not going out and explaining to people what it is they're about to do in terms of consumer protection. They have done an amazingly inept job of reminding people continuously that they were not the ones who initiated the bailout, the deficits, the AIG bailout that got us into two wars that are draining the Treasury and draining the lives of Americans. They've done a terrible job. And so most Americans actually, I think, are listening more to the very succinct sound bites that are coming from the opponents of Obama. Secondly, I would say, and Jonathan alludes to this, you know, the Republicans actually are not just trying to bury Obama. They actually believe that the policies that are being enacted will not create jobs, will not create a growing economy, will not stimulate the country, and that they are exactly the wrong medicine.
And that
business, well, I mean, you know, there is a real philosophical difference between Democrats and people who believe that government plays the most constructive role in prosperity and stimulating the economy, and those who believe that it is the private sector. And that is that struggle is going on. Yes, there are fringe arguments that come in that sort of are not very believable. But on the other hand, there is a real difference. That's why we have two parties. In some countries, they have more than two parties. Same thing is going to happen in Britain soon. They're going to have a general election, which is incredibly exciting because they never have general elections. And there is a real difference between, you know, the Labour Party and the Tories, and they're going to also articulate those differences.
Stefan, let me just step in one quick moment, because I think you're absolutely right. The Republicans are much better at the message. They're better because they actually have an opportunity to deliver this message of no in many ways, shape, or form, whether it's 3 hours a day of Beck or Rush or whatever, who's on 1,000 stations. And unfortunately, I love you, Jonathan, but not enough people listen to Iowa Public Radio. And even if they did listen to Iowa Public Radio, what Iowa Public Radio can't do that Fox does better, what Iowa Public Radio can't do that Rush does better, is that they can repeat the misinformation 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. You can get it on, you know, in your podcast and whatever. And repetition is the best teacher. It may not teach you accuracy, but it definitely imprints and teaches. So the Democrats have an obligation to get out there and learn how to deliver a message better. However, they are somewhat constrained because they have very few echo chambers out there, because I'm sorry, they just don't exist. And public radio ain't an echo chamber because you don't repeat things. That's not what you do for a living. The other thing that's so sad, however, is that I think people in their gut know that there is something with Wall Street and banks. And what I think has to happen is that Republicans have to ask themselves, even if you have a disagreement with Democrats, when you are standing there and the Chamber of Commerce and the banks and Wall Street are agreeing with your no, the American people have to sit back and say, why do I not like that conga line? Why does that group of people agreeing that no regulation makes sense make me feel uncomfortable, because no regulation is how we got into this economic mess? You see, they're going to have guilt by association. And I think that that association is not healthy for Republicans, because it suggests that they are not there to help the American people. They are basically there to cover the butt of Wall Street, which is not exactly what Americans want.
Well, Arnie, the way you make it sound is that the Republicans are in a no-win situation, because either they say no or they let Obama's agenda get through.
Oh, no. You see, here's the irony of all of this. And, Stefan, you know this too. If you look at the health care reform package that Barack Obama passed, I would say more than half to almost three-quarters of that health care reform bill are things Republicans have been demanding and asking and embracing as health care reform. The problem was that Obama was talking about it, so therefore, by definition, it had to be a negative. You know, it was Republicans who were making suggestions about having conversations at the end of life with people so they understood the kind of information they needed so they could control their own endings. It was Republicans that talked about this. Suddenly they became death panels. You know, I think what Republicans have to figure out is that they have to figure out that some kind of reform is critical, because most Americans are very suspicious of banks, because they agree the banks control Congress. The banks control Congress, not the little people, the banks.
We'll have more on this coming up on Politics Day Wednesday on Talk of Iowa with Stefan Schmidt from Iowa State University, New Hampshire-based political analyst Arnie Arneson. We'll also take your phone calls and emails, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100, or email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. Stefan Schmidt and Arnie Arneson are here for Politics Wednesday. Right now we're talking about Justice John Paul Stevens stepping down from the court and what may happen with a nominee for his replacement from President Barack Obama. Stefan and Arnie, I'd like to pitch this question in slightly a different way. Looking at recent Supreme Court history, it appears that surprises in terms of people not getting what they expected when they are appointed, presidents not getting who they expected when they appointed somebody to the bench, tended to be people who were thought to be conservative and ended up being more liberal, like Stevens or Souter. It also seems that the people who have been blocked, who were put forward for some kind of nomination and ended up not getting through, were all Republican appointees: Bork, Ginsburg, Harriet Myers. Am I forgetting some piece of history, or does this process seem to be something that tends to go worse for the Republicans than it does for the Democrats?
Well, I think the reason is the Democrats have had a majority in the Senate longer, much, much longer than Republicans. So they always had the majority. They had the, you know, the committee that actually holds the hearings and were able to, you know, get more publicity. And you're right, therefore. And Arnie, you may not have read my little piece that I did, but Senator Kennedy, Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts, the very soon after Ronald Reagan nominated Robert Bork, as you know, said Bork is America is a land where women would be forced into back alley abortions and blacks would be segregated at lunch counters and rogue police would break down citizens' doors. And he goes on and on. And then he says, no justice would be better than this injustice. And that was before the hearings even started. So, you know, the history of saying no, the Democrats have a pretty good one on Supreme Court appointees as well.
But, Stefan, the reason he could say that is that Bork was very full of himself and had written on every single topic and had an opinion on everything. I mean, part of the problem is, we'll use Bork and then we'll compare him to David Souter. Nobody knew nothing about Souter. Nothing.
Even his mother didn't.
Yeah. Even his mother, you know, he wasn't married, he lived alone. I mean, we're talking about like basically nominating a monk,
that's right.
You know? And so part of the reason why Kennedy could say this in such a full-throated way is that he was quoting Bork, you know? And that's one of the things that you have to look at when you make a decision about a justice is how damn opinionated is the person that you're appointing? What do you know about those opinions? And, you know, will they make it that much more difficult for that person to get to the bench? I mean, the one of the people they're talking about is the former dean of Harvard Law School. Well, nobody really knows her opinion on a lot of things. They know she's bright. You know, they know she was useful as the dean at Harvard Law School. You know, they admire her, but they really don't know her opinions on a whole raft of issues.
Well,
and is that such a bad thing? I'm not quite so sure.
My advice to Obama is don't appoint anyone with either a Harvard, Yale, or Columbia law degree, because we have our government is entirely tilted like the Titanic in its last moments to an East Coast elite that even when they're Democrats or Republicans, they just think alike. There is this groupthink that clusters around New Haven and Cambridge and, you know, the upper west side of New York around Columbia. And it is the way that policy and law in this country is made. I think he ought to go and pick somebody, you know, from Iowa or from some other place, someone no one has ever heard of, who is brilliant, who has never been a judge, who has no court cases, maybe even somebody who's not even a lawyer, because, you know, you don't have to be a lawyer and certainly not a judge to be nominated to the court. Somebody fresh and exciting and interesting that neither the Democrats nor the Republicans will have a clue as to what they would do. And that would make a lot of, I think, buzz as well, wouldn't it?
Well, but didn't Souter pretty much ruin it for everybody of either party?
That's right.
I understand what you're saying, Stephen.
He better be married, and he better have contributed to a politician once in his life. Otherwise, we're not picking.
Well, there's that old saying, the devil you know is always better than the devil you don't.
That's true.
And I'm wondering if Souter kind of ruined that kind of, you know, let's just go with someone that we don't know a lot about, but we think is just smart.
Yeah, you're right.
Well, isn't that sad?
My bad.
Smart is now a liability. Look what you just said, Jonathan. Just smart. Oh, my God. I could revel in that one.
We don't even need smart. I mean.
Yeah. It's gonna be. I mean, the problem right now is there is so many issues on everyone's plate. And, of course, Barack Obama's got everybody sort of now focused on the whole loose nukes issue and what's happening with nuclear policy. And, you know, Republicans are saying he's making us, you know, more vulnerable. And I'm thinking, honey, you know how vulnerable we are if nuclear material gets into the hands of a terrorist.
That's
This is a great opportunity for him, because look at all the leaders he was able to bring to the table. I mean, if that isn't a sign of respect and leadership on an issue that probably is more volatile than most people know, here's the dilemma, because, Stefan, you are absolutely right. We have done a bad job of explaining to the American people why this, for example, is such a critical issue.
Sure.
It is more critical than anyone has a clue to, but he didn't really lay a foundation. The leaders know, but if the people don't know, then they can't follow.
Well, yeah, and what people think now is what you're hearing on late talk radio and stuff, which is Obama is pulling the teeth out of the United States' capacity of defending itself. The United States is now going to become a vulnerable country. Our position as the number one power in the world is going to now disappear. You know, by bringing down nuclear weapons, you know, what he's going to do is basically now make it easier, actually, for North Korea and Iran and other countries that will have nuclear weapons because they'll have parity with us. And, you know, all of this stuff, that this is a treacherous act, that he is a traitor, that he is betraying, you know, 65 years of American very solid policy, which depended on nuclear weapons as a deterrent. And that's what they're hearing, because that is the information that is flowing like, you know, like liquid throughout the country. They're not hearing the other argument, which is, you know, we do have to secure these because there's too much of this stuff rolling around all over the place, and we can't keep an eye on it. So let's get it all rounded up. And I think it's astonishing that these countries like, you know, Argentina and other countries are saying, yeah, we have some nuclear fissionable material, and what we're going to do is we're going to transport it to the United States so that you can secure it. I mean, that's a real sign of some sort of international cooperation, that they're going to have us basically become the guarantors of the security of it. I think that's pretty
Jonathan,
neat.
Let me share something with you, because when I was a fellow at Harvard, there was a meeting once where they train military guys for a year on leadership issues. And we sat at a table one day. This is in 1997, everyone. And we said to them, these are top military brass. And we said to them, so what is the issue that most frightens you? 1997, it was loose nukes. Mm-hmm. And I never even heard the term before. And here I had run for Congress and run for governor. I'm going, loose what? And they proceeded to describe to us their concerns. By the time they got done with the meal, you could peel most of us off the floor. We were so terrified. And this is 1997. And that's part of the story. I need those military guys to be on every single news station describing what they described to me in 97. And everybody would be looking at Barack Obama going, why didn't we do this 5 years ago, 10 years ago? Why are you able to do it now? How vulnerable have we been? That's the kind of conversation that I think should have preceded this, or at least needs to happen.
Yeah, but the Democrats are really bad at doing this. So, you know.
Well, but wasn't the election of Barack Obama at some level a pushback against the Bush administration's focus on security first, other things second?
Yeah, but what you just said is wrong. This is ultimately about the most important security. We are incredibly vulnerable to nuclear material getting into the hands of someone else. We're not worried about nuclear material, frankly, with India or Russia or China. We're much more worried when someone gets it into the hands because Pakistan or Russia has its nuclear material basically protected by a chain link fence with holes in it. You know, it's not what Russia will do with the material. It's what some terrorists will do with the material. This is number one about security, much more so than George Bush ever focused on security.
Well,
that's the problem.
Well, we'll talk a little. When we come back from our break, we'll talk a little bit more about the Supreme Court. Then we'll talk a little more about loose nukes, and still like to touch on NASA.
Yeah.
By the end of the hour. Yeah. President Obama is going to be speaking on that today, and that has some possible political ramifications as well. So after the environment report, we'll come back, take a couple of calls, finish up on Supreme Court, talk about loose nukes and NASA. That's coming up in the second half of Talk of Iowa. It's Politics Day. Stephen Schmidt and Arnie Arneson are our guests. Your phone calls and emails at 866-780-9100. Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Jonathan All. We'll be back in a few minutes.
Tar sands, dirty oil, and big oil stockholders. This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. Several investors groups want four major oil companies to reveal the risks of getting oil from Canadian tar sands. Rebecca Williams is here. It looks like shareholders will be considering this at BP's general meeting tomorrow.
Yes, they will be. Tar sands are kind of like they sound. They're sand or clay soaked in oil. Canada's tar sands are the second largest oil reserves in the world, so you can imagine the oil companies are all over them. But it's a dirtier source of oil. Several investors groups have filed shareholder resolutions with BP, ConocoPhillips, Shell, and ExxonMobil. They want these companies to reveal the risks to stockholders of getting oil from tar sands. Emily Stone is with Green Century Capital Management.
We want these companies to be more forthright about what they see as the big risks to their companies in the oil sands and how they're mitigating those risks.
She says these risks include dealing with pollution and lawsuits from native tribes that live near the oil sands.
So I'm sure the oil companies have gone on record on this. What do they want?
Well, BP did not want to talk to me for the story on tape, but in a statement to shareholders, they were telling them to vote no, and they said that these oil sands in Canada are a proven and secure source of oil.
Okay, thanks, Reb.
You're welcome.
This is the Environment Report. There's a new resurgence in the business co-op model. There are new co-op bakeries, co-op solar companies, laundries. Julie Grant reports on these new employee-owned, often green-focused businesses.
Around the area known as University Circle in Cleveland, streets are lined with boarded-up foreclosed homes, and the signs of poverty are everywhere. Drugs, crime, and unemployment. So Mynion Smith is glad to have a job. She's 31 years old and has five kids. She sorts laundry into large bins. But this isn't the same as any other job. Smith and the other eight workers are all about to become part owners.
We all have a goal to eventually own this facility. So we work harder to let them know that, hey, we're in it for the long haul.
Smith and the other workers will buy into the cooperative. Since none of them has the $3,000 up front, they'll each give 50 cents an hour from their paycheck. Jim Anderson is with the Employee Ownership Center at Kent State University. He signed the papers for $6 million in loans to start up the Evergreen Cooperative Laundry. In 3 years, he says the first nine employees will be owners. Starting a worker-owned business during a recession might seem crazy, but Anderson says Evergreen is on track to succeed. Plus, he says they have a market advantage. They've gone green. They bought washing machines that save water and ironing presses that save energy.
We're the green laundry. We're going to reduce your carbon footprint more than anybody else will. And we think, given that, we'll get the nod from the customer.
The co-op's customers are mostly hospitals, nursing homes, and hotels, a stable, local customer base. Evergreen is also starting a co-op solar company, a co-op greenhouse, and a co-op newspaper in Cleveland. Gar Alperovitz is author of the book America Beyond Capitalism. He says Americans are sick of overpaid CEOs and companies that abandon a community as soon as they find better tax breaks or cheaper labor.
The local economy decays, the tax base decays, the environment decays, and the question becomes, are we going to do something ourselves? Or are we going to just allow the decay to go on?
In Cleveland, they expect the group of co-op businesses to employ up to 1,000 people in the next 5 years, all from the neighborhoods that need the help.
And that's the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham.
Support comes from the Park Foundation, the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, and the Great Lakes Fishery Trust. You can find more information and post your comments at environmentreport.org. The Environment Report comes from the University of Michigan.
This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. Stephen Schmidt and Arnie Arneson are our guests for Politics Day here on the program. And we're going to go to a couple of phone calls to open this part of the show. Let's go to Dan in Fort Dodge. Dan, you're on the program.
Good morning. I just called to supplement what Arnie Arneson had to say about getting a Supreme Court justice that would have the good sense to recuse him or herself. Had we had some of them in 2000 when the Bush versus Gore was heard by the Supreme Court, we never would have had George Bush as president. We never would have had the Iraq War and 3,500 or 4,000 deceased and 18,000 other casualties because Sandra Day O'Connor did not recuse herself, even though she had previously stated publicly that she wouldn't resign until her successor could be appointed by a Republican. And Samuel Alito did not recuse himself, even though he had two sons working on behalf of the Bush campaign.
Yeah. Thank you.
Dan, thanks for your call. I'm wondering, though, I mean, is it really practical to have mass recusings on the Supreme Court? Because then you'd pretty much have to find a hermit who's never done anything to be on the court.
But but let me just make a point. No one's saying that you have to not be appointed to the bench. All we're saying is that when there's a case in controversy that's coming before you and you have a relationship, like Clarence Thomas has a relationship to Monsanto because he was their legal counsel for a number of years, you just say, on this case, I will not participate. Amen. It's over. No one's saying that he can't, you know, participate on a case dealing with, I don't know, Cargill, you know, but he can on Monsanto. And that's where I think I think people need to understand that that is problematic because we are going to get justices who do have an interesting background. You don't want to preclude them from being on the court for a whole host of reasons. You just don't want them to participate in cases where they have a connection. Another justice, for example, is going to recuse himself on a case dealing with Monsanto because his brother was a federal judge who at some point in time may have worked on a case of this nature. He's willing to recuse himself. I guess I need to know, is there a standard? And if you're going to appoint someone to the bench, what the heck is their standard?
How loosey-goosey
is it?
Well, yeah, and their larger problem really is the whole sort of static nature of the Supreme Court. And I'm going to tell you two things that we really need to do. We need to increase the number of Supreme Court justices because what 9 justices could accomplish at the beginning of this republic, you know, 200 and some years later, 9 justices probably is not enough to handle the complexity and the volume. They ought to handle more cases. They can't handle them, and they do stare decisis and let standings of lower courts, you know, be the law because they can't handle more cases. So I would like to see the Supreme Court probably doubled in size. Number two, I would like to see the Supreme Court members no longer be appointed for life. I think that that is that might have been realistic when nothing changed in society over the 90 years of a person's lifetime. But in 2010, in the 21st century, things change so rapidly, both technologically and especially in terms of social institutions, that to have someone appointed for life essentially anchors the country in a past that no longer exists. And I think that is a very counterproductive thing. So I'd like to see Supreme Court justices appointed, let's say, for 10-year terms, so that a president who can only have 2 4-year terms, you know, cannot really mess with the court and replace it. But after 10 years, the justices can go back to real life where they don't have a lot of the most brilliant people in the country working for them, you know, making the cases for them, and where they don't have this monastic life. Because life in the Supreme Court is a lot like being a monk. I mean, they're in there, they're isolated, they're venerated. They often really isolate themselves from the reality of society, and their values tend to be a representative of only a certain segment of American society. So I'd like to see the court turn over more quickly and have people have to go back and deal with things that are a little bit less ethereal. And I think that would help, because then if you had more justices, you know, if one or two justices recuse themselves from a case where they have a conflict of interest, you still have legs to continue to push those cases through.
And there really is a point of the reason I'm bringing this up is that right now there is a case coming up before the court. Stephen Breyer has decided to recuse himself because Charles Breyer, the judge who ruled in this original decision in 2007, is his brother. And he says, look, I can't. My brother ruled in the first case. I'm not going to touch it. Clarence Thomas, who worked for Monsanto from 76 to 79, said, no, it doesn't matter that I worked for them and I was their legal counsel. I am not going to see this as a conflict of interest, so I am not going to recuse myself. I just think people need to understand that there is an issue. Where do you go when a Supreme Court justice chooses not to recuse themselves? You're stuck. There's
you
nowhere
can't appeal
for you
it
to
anywhere.
Appeal
you can't
anywhere.
Appeal
exactly.
it anywhere.
Exactly. Thank you very much.
Let's. Rick has in Iowa City has a question on that. Rick, are you on the line? We do not have Rick.
Rick left
us. Let's go to Julie in Benton County. Julie, you have a comment on the Supreme Court.
Hello.
Yes, Julie. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. Okay. Thank you, Jonathan, for taking my call. Hello, Arnie. Take a deep breath.
Okay,
Julie,
we've spoken for a long time.
We've got two topics that we want to get to. Please be very concise with your comment.
I'll try to make it brief then. The Supreme Court nominee, I would like to hear what you think about the constitutionality, not only of the issue of mandating a choice by an individual pertaining to insurance as a product. Do you think it's legal to pass a law requiring us to visit spend our money on a product?
Thanks, Julie. I think we get your point. Do you think Arnie Stephan, do you think that the next Supreme Court justice is going to be end up being a referendum on the health care bill the way that Julie would like it to be?
Sure. I think she raises an interesting point and an important point.
It's not my decision.
Well, no, but I think that it is a question that is worth probably once again revisiting, which is where are the limits of government essentially mandating people to have to spend their money on certain products or to have certain coverage. Now, at the state level, we have no problem with states mandating that if you're driving a car, you have to have car insurance. And I think at the state level, there would be no problem if states said to people, you need to have health insurance. Massachusetts has kind of proven that the state seems to have the constitutional legitimacy to do that. The only question is whether that is, in fact, under the American Constitution, a national matter, a federal matter, or whether that falls into the jurisdiction of the state's authority. And I think that's an interesting constitutional question.
And I think the other thing you could suggest is that you could say, I don't have to buy insurance. And if you choose not to buy insurance, then you pay the penalty.
You go to
and
jail,
the good news
yeah.
is very, very, but no, not
no,
go to jail.
Don't
so
to
don't
jail,
say that, Stefan.
Oh.
That's the misinformation.
Oh, I wish
go to jail.
Go
it's
go
the
to
IRS
jail.
That they're going to hire all these new people, packing heat. You can make the choice. There'll be financial consequences to that choice, but you can make the choice. You're not going to go to jail. You're not going to be given a number. You're just going to be given a fine. Big deal. You can speed too, but at some point, I think you're absolutely right. But see, I agree with her. I don't want the government to tell me to buy a product I hate, and I hate private insurance. So I agree with her. But the problem is, it isn't whether I agree with her or not. The question then becomes, is it constitutional? And does the government have an opt-out by saying, no one's forcing you, because if you choose not to do it, you just pay the fine. That's all.
Let's move on to another topic. Loose nukes. John from Des Moines got a comment on this that can launch the discussion. John, go ahead.
Well, it isn't going to do you much good to have an agreement like with the Russians, because a lot of their regions that are breaking away. They have their own foreign trade deals, their own foreign policy, and some of them have taken over the nukes, like I think it's Kazakhstan, where they had the coup. The displaced leader, he took over three of the former Soviet missile silos, so he...
Kyrgyzstan,
about,
right?
Yeah, Kyrgyzstan.
Kyrgyzstan.
Yeah, and...
So John, your point is what good is a treaty like the one that Obama's pushing when there are these rogue elements even within Russia or the old Soviet Union?
Well, they're not rogues. These are regional leaders who they have the support of their people. For example,
that
one
some
case,
people would call rogue.
Well, yeah.
Okay, Steph, Arnie, what's your take on that?
Well, he's right, except that the idea here is, and he did have 47 leaders at this meeting, and it included some leaders. For example, Ukraine is a former part of the Soviet Empire, and Ukraine seems to be very anxious to participate in this because the threat is there for them as well. I mean, especially countries that are politically unstable are countries that themselves are very fearful of those nuclear material or even nuclear weapons, but usually it's just nuclear material falling into the hands of unpredictable groups. So in the case of Kyrgyzstan, I'm sure that the former president is just sweating it out, because if that material fell into the hands of all those rioters and looters and others who overthrew him, they might use it against him. And so countries, governments do seem to have a necessity or at least have a conscience in understanding that this stuff is not good for them either. And if Obama can get more people on board and can get regional leaders to invite other regional leaders to participate in this, it's a win-win situation for everybody. So,
and everything has its price, Jonathan. I mean, and I think that you can actually even pay people to say, why don't I buy this material from you? You don't want to protect it anyway. You're not using it anyway. We will buy it. It's much cheaper than dealing with, you know, what happens after the fact if it gets into the hand of a terrorist. We know how to spend money. This is probably a very wise investment.
And we've had this. Sam Nunn, you know, has been working on trying to secure
91,
nuclear material for
since 91.
Years. Exactly. Yeah. But so and it's bipartisan. I mean, Democrats and Republicans, in the past at least, wanted to secure this stuff. We've been working on it. It's just that now we need to make an additional push because the urgency is greater because there are more terrorist groups.
Is there any way, though, to and this isn't a partisan Democrat or Republican thing, but is there any real way to 100% protect against loose nukes when short of having an international police force that can keep track of every group of 10 or more people that have any kind of resources at all, other than trying to build these coalitions and trying to get as many people on the same page to identify it as a problem?
No, there isn't. But, you know, you want to reduce it down so that the probability is less. You know, the more of this stuff there is floating around, the greater the likelihood that it's going to fall into the wrong hands. So you want to shrink the pool, and then you want to be able to monitor. And yes, of course, there will. It's like terrorism. You know, you want to try to reduce the numbers of groups and their capacity as much as you can, with the understanding always that you can never eliminate it, and that there will be terrorist acts, and that the possibilities are smaller the fewer of those there are. So it's just a mathematical thing, I think.
And I think the Chinese and the Russians are equally frightened.
Well, they're worried
so,
about it.
So the good news is that vigilance is much better than apathy. Yep.
Oh, there's nothing to get countries together like mutual fear.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, you know, that's the Tea Party protesters. What's brought them together is mutual fear.
Yeah.
And that's really what it is. Now the question is their leader Sarah Palin, who just earned a cool $12 million plus? But that's
I knew you were going to get that in, Arnie.
I had to get that in.
Well, you know, those Democrats like Arnie, they're opposed to anybody making more than a few thousand dollars a month. So.
Oh, no. That's not true. I just want to make sure you pay your taxes.
Oh, okay.
All right, let's go to the space program. And before we do this, Arnie, I got to ask you if I need to recuse myself on this, because my 6-year-old son loves space and he wants to be on a manned mission to Mars.
You need to recuse yourself.
Don't, because I think Barack Obama is going to do a slight mea culpa when he talks on Thursday, and he's going to say, oh, I meant to get rid of this little program, but I'm actually looking at a much bigger program. Mm-hmm. So I think Barack has heard a lot from a lot of very, very angry astronauts about what's going on, and the idea that somehow in order to, what is it, called Soyuz, that we'd pay like $50 million for it.
To the Russians, right.
To the Russians, I'm thinking, wait
a minute. That is wicked cab fare, I tell you.
Yes, exactly. I remember, is that really what we want to do? And do I want to trust them that this will be a seat with like a safety belt?
But their airplanes are safe.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. That airplane from Poland that killed the entire elite of Poland was an old Russian airplane. I forgot about that. But, Jonathan, here's my spin on the Obama effort to sort of change the mission of the space program. For the United States, the leading space-faring nation for nearly half a century to be without carriage to low Earth orbit, and with no human exploration capability to go beyond Earth orbit for an indeterminate time into the future, destines our nation to become a second or even third-rate country. I didn't say that. Neil Armstrong said that in a letter that is circulating now that I don't think he meant really to be public. But that's the counter argument, that the United States still needs to have manned space missions, that we want feet on the ground, that we shouldn't be changing the mission of NASA so that it becomes an agency that tests Toyota brakes that are failing. Oops, that was something that came out in the news the other day, and the right-wing media went nuts. They said, our space program, we're the greatest in the world. Now they're testing, you know, brakes for a Japanese car company. So this is kind of controversial. On the other hand, our space program, you know, is expensive, and we managed to have a space program in the first place only for one reason and one reason alone, and it had nothing to do with science. It had nothing to do with exploring space.
It had to do with Russia.
It had to do with national security and, you know, getting beyond, you know, the first satellite in the world and the first animals that were put into orbit, which were Russians, which panicked the United States. And that's how John F. Kennedy managed to get the U.S. and Congress to fund such a huge project. We don't have an enemy right now where the space program is
that
compelling.
That might have been the genesis, and I wasn't alive in 1969, but talking to my parents and my older relatives, when the U.S. got to the moon, the national reaction wasn't, take that, Russia. It was, wow, we did this. So is President Obama missing out on a big opportunity to find one of those things that can inspire a generation of the next technological thinkers the way that the first real space program did?
I think we've become jaded.
Yeah.
I think the problem is because of what we're able to do technologically on the movie screen and because of what we're able to do with our computers. I don't think that there's the same kind of thrill and excitement. I don't think we dream that way anymore. I'm crushed by saying that, Jonathan, but I know how exciting it was when we landed a man on the moon because I was going to a camp that had no electricity. They actually brought an electric line into my camp just so we could watch TV that night.
But do you remember when we crashed that vehicle into the moon to see if there was water in that crater and everybody sat around, we watched, it crashed in, nothing happened. And we said, well, that was pretty boring, forget about it. You know, the actual space exploration doesn't produce the same kind of stuff that fantastic graphics can produce, you know.
When the Hubble Space Telescope was fixed.
Right.
And it came back. And when the Mars rover was crawling around out there, there were glimpses of that.
Yeah, that's right.
That were bad. So do we – and one of the many space programs I watch with my son, one of those very learned scientists said that after the Apollo program, all of the space effort was spent in low orbit. That would be equivalent to Columbus going and discovering the New World and then every explorer after that for 30 years just dinking around the coast of Spain.
Yeah, that's true. It's true, but you know – I think there is a certain amount of let's call it incapacity of telling what's reality and what isn't. There is so much science fiction, and I think this generation, for the most part, except for kids like yours, sort of think that there's a lot of exploration going on. You can play video games that have a reality level that is almost as real life. There are a lot of scientific things being done. And for some reason, the question about the space program that would have to be answered is, why do we want to do this? Do we want to do it to find the origin of life? Do we want to do it in order to find places where we can find more minerals? Do we want to do it so we can transport a colony there? Because we know that in 2012, when the Mayan calendar comes true, the Earth is going to finish and we're going to have to go there. So what is the reason for doing it? Because pure science, you can't sell that very easily down at the Walmart. You really can't.
Well, can I just make a point, though? I think what has to happen is I think that all the people from NASA have to point to all the commercial applications from all the things that have happened as a result of NASA and tell people that the reason why their lives are so different, the reason why we are so much more technologically savvy is it can go directly back to the experimentation and the opportunities that have been developed at NASA. That is part of what I would do is in order to be – we have to start connecting the dots for people. We just assume that they dream like Armstrong. They don't. Neil, you're the only one. Now the question is how can we give them something practical and take some of the dreamers and add the practicality to it and say it's a worthy investment?
Well, has society changed – so much that it's impossible for Barack Obama or any other president to give a Kennedy-esque-like speech and say, we need to put a base on the moon because we need to do it. And we need to have a manned mission to Mars, not because it's easy, but because it's hard. Is society so gone from that that can't happen anymore?
The answer is yes. Because if Obama says it, the Republicans and conservatives are going to go nuts. If George W. Bush had said it, Democrats and liberals would have said, this guy is crazy. He's trying to set up a military base up there, and, you know, we don't trust him. So when Kennedy was president, to some extent at least, I think we still respected presidents for an impartial authority, even if we disagreed with them on certain things. I think that credibility is gone, and I don't know when it's going to come back. I mean, people don't trust the other party anymore, you know?
And there's an article I want everyone to read. Go to Salon.com, and the article is by Andrew Leonard, and it's entitled The Incredible Shrinking Deficit. And the reason they said is it's because of the fiscal stimulus and because of rising tax revenues. And I just want to look at it. People keep thinking that, you know, the stimulus just added to the debt. It may, in fact, be bringing down the deficit. Why do I bring this up? Because people have to be educated. They make assumptions, and the assumptions are wrong.
I know that my son can't vote for 12 years, but he's waiting for a president to say, we're going to Mars.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a deal.
Sarah Palin will do that.
Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Production assistance today from Christina Sarnelli. We're always welcoming your comments and questions. Contact us anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was performed and composed by Dan Knight. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Thanks, Steph and Arnie. We'll be back next week. This is Talk of Iowa.